watching it like, this dude is on one. He's just down there on his own. That's impressive, man. Like, you know, the hats off to you for actually doing that. All the armchair skeptics sitting there saying this, that, and the other. Here's a guy that's literally getting the sand in his fingernails and going down into the tunnels and finding it.
This dirt that is now blocking up that tunnel is, it wasn't there at first. There's hundreds of gated entrances and shafts on the plateau itself. Shafts just full of sand, shafts that are gated, doors that go into cliff sides that are gated. And that was my point. People don't realize how many entrances there are right on the plateau.
Some of the footage, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen any of this footage before of these different entrances, you know, going into these places, into the tunnel to actually get the evidence. Yes, it's blocked off. There is more to this. Again, guys, the ancient stories, the relatively contemporary stories from early archaeologists and explorers, like this is something that seems to have been very quickly hushed up in the modern era.
It's real. There are these energy fields where if you enter into them, it's going to make you sick. There are these pockets that are, it's like radiation almost. You walk into and you get sick. These tunnels were, it was unbelievable. They were full. I mean, they're 10, 12 feet wide and tall, square.
What?
The Vatican Museum, where the pine cone is, and there's the big, you know, this is all a metaphor for the pineal gland. And
they know exactly what's going on. What a crazy situation that's unfolding right now in Egypt. Would love to get just your first impressions on like the story breaking and the reception from it, like the kind of critiques and the support. How do you feel about the way it's all unfolding?
Been a bit of a surprise for me, but not really. I've been preparing. I've been in touch with the team since last year, maybe at least 6 months ago, 8 months ago. Yeah, I can explain, first of all, what's happened this week, and then we can maybe explain more of the backstory. But I had basically done all this work in Egypt with my friend William Brown and Richard Gabriel. It coincided with some of the discoveries that they had come out with, the Great Pyramid discoveries, in 2022. So there was overlap between the two projects, and we believed that we had discovered this tunnel that actually goes straight to the Great Pyramid and accesses all the chambers that they found back then. So I wrote to the team, finally reached Corrado somehow, and he got back to me from the team. They said, yeah, we've seen some of this work, we're aware, and we'd love to work together in the future potentially. Basically, we got in touch at that point, and they told me also, you know, I was basically trying to ask if I could help them get this story out. And when they released their 2022 report, It was such a shock to, I mean, I'd been looking for this stuff forever, going way back. So when it first came out, I was right on it and astonished by it. And yeah, that paper did really hold up very well. It was very nice, thorough. They really got into their method. They showed how they made the models from the scans and all of that.
This new paper, though, that's come out, has that been fully released? Is that available to download anywhere in the same format as the 2022 study?
The abstract is available in PDF form, but that's one thing I haven't. I've kind of tried to ask them if they're going to release a full paper on this whole thing or when they might release it, but I haven't got an answer to that yet. So I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
But
because a lot of people are confused. One thing I've noticed is a lot of people are conflating this with the 2022 study at the Great Pyramid of Giza. And like, I have to take some responsibility for my rushed video where I did actually call it the Great Pyramid of Giza. So like, you know, totally my fault on that one. And I've been trying to correct the record on some people, but there's a lot of people who are referencing that. And this is not the case. It is a new study, right?
Yes. Very good point. By the way, you were, as far as I know, the second person to make a video as soon as what happened on Saturday was I got an email with this abstract. It was a short, like 5-6 page abstract about the conference that they just did. And I asked Armando, I double checked and was like, is it okay for me to release this? And he said it was. So, but yeah, I just put it out on my Facebook because I didn't have anywhere else to put it for one thing. And I didn't know how to put the full PDF there either. So I just did screenshots. That was all I could do. But I didn't think it was going to affect the credibility of the whole project in any way, or be, you know, because I thought that everyone that was at the conference, that was the day of the conference last Saturday when they released the abstract with it. But I thought they released it to everyone at the conference and that everyone at the conference would be reporting on the whole thing at that time. So I put it down on my Facebook. Armando said I could, and I was like, all right, here it goes.
Well, hey, look, man, you got the green light. You got the green light. You're not responsible for the wildfire that took place afterwards, and it certainly has been a wildfire. It just kind of caught all over the internet, TikTok, Instagram, mainstream media, and like a lot of knee-jerk reactions and a lot of, like I said, like assumptions, including the use of the type of technology. I tried to correct the record on that, that they're not claiming they can penetrate 2 kilometers of rock and get like incredible scans of objects. It's more about measuring the surface level or like subsurface level vibrations that are being caused, right?
Yeah, there's definitely less resolution the further down you go. And people are also confused that is SAR technology real? It's not. I mean, it is real. I meant, is SAR technology new? And it's not. But the method that Filippo Biondi has developed is new. He has brought new things to this. He's really an expert on that technology. He's used it a lot in the past in other kinds of projects, you know, relating to looking into earth science stuff. And
right, like he's an established scientist in this field. He's got proof of concept. He's done this before.
Very, very professional. He's definitely very well able to explain it all. And now at this point, that the full 4-hour conference is out, so you can go see him explain all of that, which is great because I don't have to defend all that. But
right.
When it did first come out, I really appreciate it, even if it wasn't perfect. Everyone was confused about how this related to the 2022 paper.
And,
it had nothing to do with it. It's a new project, and this was it did have some text with it that explained what some of these images were, and it was kind of like a sample. It was like the trailer for the movie, and people are like, they shouldn't put this out before it's peer reviewed. And it's like, how are people going to know to watch their presentation if they have no idea about anything that's going on? And also, I really want to say that last time when they released the 22 paper, the media blacked it out. The mainstream media right. still has not reported on their 2022 discovery, which was the greatest discovery in the history of Egypt, if you ask.
Well, this is what I said in my recent upload, that, you know, you have to take into account that this type of very controversial subject matter evolving around Egypt and specifically the Giza Plateau and the pyramids, this is already very heated territory for the mainstream. They've kind of got their models, they've established a status quo, and they're willing to defend that. And anyone coming up into that is going to be pretty much all the time rejected automatically, just at face value, based on what they're saying and proposing. And, you know, you bring up anything related to something like the Halls of Amenti, you might as well kiss it goodbye, right? Because they're going to go, okay, you're just an esoteric nut. But the thing is, this deep, esoterically entrenched history of Egypt is just objectively viable and findable online. Like, we know that this is something that they venerated and they, you know, deeply held in their symbology. So it's weird to kind of ignore the esoteric researchers and the people that have been studying these things. But you're going to be relegated to the fringe. You're going to be relegated to these kind of smaller conferences like the one that they've had to do, because the mainstream's going to reject them automatically. So my point of defense in relationship to some people saying, oh, look at this corny conference with these graphics of a pyramid with the eye, you know, it all looks a little bit cheesy. And it's like, yeah, okay, fair enough. But at the same time, where were they supposed to go? No major academic conference is going to hold space for this. So where are they supposed to go? So I'm, you know, willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on that.
Yeah. Well, if you don't have a ministry approval for your project, if Zahi doesn't get behind it, it's not going to be covered by the mainstream news. It is going against the grain of so many things that we're told about our past. And there is, like you say, such a precedent for this. Giza has always been the most locked down site on the planet. It's always been nearly impossible to get any access. But in the past years, and probably in part due to some of the stuff I've been doing with Bill and Richard and other disclosures that are going on there, where independent people are going in there and bringing forward video proof of, for instance, I just released this film revealing NC2 2 days before the conference, because we know that the cave system that Andrew Collins found up in the northwest of the plateau, we do believe that it connects straight over the Great Pyramid. And Andrew actually brought forward back in 2008 when he first found it, this TerraSAR X scan of the plateau where you see this cave going straight from NC2 to the Middle Pyramid. And he just released another film about that yesterday also.
And is that the same cave system in 2008 that Zahi Hawass denied the existence of and then eventually went down 6 months later and took some selfies inside of it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Just keep that in mind, people. Just keep that in mind.
Zahi initially said there's absolutely no cave system. This thing's only 35 meters long. He's talking about the Tomb of the Bird structure, which is a separate... It opens up into this cave that goes another 350 feet back. So when Andrew brought attention to it, first he said there's no cave at all, and then he realized there was one. He put the gate on it after Andrew brought attention to it, brought his own team in, and they went to the very back end of it, and you have what's called the tube tunnel at the end. It's this very narrow structure you have to crawl through. And when Andrew and Richard first were going in there, my friend Richard Gabriel, he was going in there around that same time and doing all this great research. That tunnel was not blocked up at that point. And this is actually something I didn't mention in the film. I should have made more clear. I totally, is one thing I really want to mention is that this dirt that is now blocking up that tunnel is, it wasn't there at first. And nobody went through it when it was open. But basically right around when the gate was put up, the back end tunnel was blocked with dirt. And we believe it was blocked from the opposite side.
What makes you believe that? That it was blocked from the opposite side?
For one thing, the way it's just dirt that's been like piled in there, but you have to crawl in there like, you know, 15 to 20 feet or so before the blockage. And there's no dirt spilled in that whole area. Right. No one carried a shovel of dirt, you know,
right.
without spilling any on the floor. It's like you can see that the way the dirt lies, it's like someone was throwing it in from the other side. But there's other contextual evidence as well that's saying, like this satellite that image that Andrew had brought forward initially, it shows these two caves that go straight over to the middle pyramid, which is what led him to also believe that this connects to things that are under the Khafre pyramid, the middle one that's called G2, which is the one we're now seeing all this stuff under. So, He basically came up with that idea, and we agreed with him on that because there's also the records of Henry Salt and Giovanni Caviglia from 1817, where they described going past this tube tunnel structure, and they say past that there was one spacious chamber, and then that communicated to three others of equal dimensions, from which issued many labyrinthine passages.
Right, because there's a lot of references, even some quite contemporary references, like you said, from the 1800s and like the early 19th century, of different passageways and pathways. And, you know, before we move into what you've been doing, because my God, I've been watching some of your documentary work and you have been exploring like every corner and inch of the Giza Plateau, filming things that I had no idea about. I was excitedly posting about them today because I didn't realize that some of these things were actually present on the site. I didn't see them when I went, and I'm definitely going back to Cairo as soon as I can to try and do some more exploration. But before we move into that, I just want to touch on the mainstream kind of response to the Khafre project and, you know, the findings of the team. Do you think that there is any hope for them actually gaining credibility in the mainstream with this, with more data and more information, or has the damage been done? And was it always kind of inevitable that this is how it was going to be treated by the mainstream? Like, do you think that they're going to break out of the fringe because this is so important? And if they really have got these types of structures proven empirically, this is literally the most important thing that's happening in the world in regards to history and the implications of it. So how do you feel it's going to actually end up doing in the mainstream with the kind of development of evidence?
I think in the long run, it's going to have to be seen as something, at least. People might still, now that the whole conference is out, they went into such detail. They showed so many of the actual scans, which is what everyone wanted. Everyone, all the real scientists, none of them said, it's a hoax. They said, we'll wait and look at it. We're not going to judge until we see the information. And now that it's out, they put so many more scans in there. If people want to question exactly how accurate their models are, that might still go on. That can be a debate, but there's no question that they're showing something that is enormous. And it looks like the shape they're describing in these models, as far as we can tell. But there could be some, you know, people kind of speculating as to exactly how accurate it is. But if you're talking about a structure that's 600 meters How accurate does it really matter? I mean, if you're a few meters off or something, it's still an enormous structure that nobody's ever seen.
Well, they released in the new conference, they released some higher fidelity images of those spiraling structures. Do you know, because I'm not 100% sure how they were able to kind of get that. Is it through reducing the noise? Is it AI and algorithmically based? Like, how did they get rid of the noise and really get a refined spiral like that? Do you know?
As far as the actual technical details of the scanning, I won't try to represent them because I'm not an expert on this.
I know you're not officially on the team, like, you know, you're not
Nothing I
officially
say
working like
can be
that.
reflected on the team. I'm a friend of them and I'm trying to help them get it out, but I want to make that clear because Armando also said this yesterday. He made a post and he said, you know, our official team representation is Nicola Ciccolo on her YouTube page. So I was like, yes, thank you. I am not representing this, but as far as any of the details concerning the actual technology, I've been referring people to my friend Manu Seifzadeh, who is an absolute genius. He is in my opinion the world leading Egyptologist, Manu Seifzadeh. So that's Manu Seifzadeh.
What's his deal? What's his interest?
He's a brilliant Egyptologist in terms of he's been looking into, he wrote a book called Under the Sphinx, which is probably the greatest ever explanation of why we know that these halls of records or this sacred archive was actually buried at Giza under the Sphinx, based on evidence that is not just like Edgar Cayce, you know, and the classic psychic reading that Edgar Cayce gave, which
For people that don't know, could you explain that briefly?
Well, Edgar Cayce was a world-renowned psychic. He gave over 14,000 psychic readings in his life, which is by far the largest body of material ever collected from a single psychic source. Later on in his life, he started realizing he was looking back in people's lives, seeing their past lives, telling the world all these things about Atlantis, and that after this cataclysm, these records from the past Golden Age were taken to Egypt and to other lands as well, to the Yucatan, and buried in these repositories so that after this dark age had come, we would come back to a point where we could dig this up and recover all of this knowledge and technology that came from this previous age of civilization that was wiped out basically by the flood and these cataclysms, which is back towards that era of like 10,500 BC, which so many researchers have focused on.
Right. And I've been looking today. I've been reviewing the Secret Underworld of Giza, which is the documentary or part one, The Lion and the Labyrinth, which you put together. And I mean, I'm blown away by some of the video footage. I'm going to be playing all of this right now, so everyone who's listening, you know, this is all on screen as we're talking. The amount of doorways, just objectively, obviously there, like old ones, newer ones, gated ones, they are littering this entire plateau, aren't they?
I've got a few videos I just shared on Facebook about this in the past few weeks, where I show at least 100. There's hundreds of gated entrances and shafts on the plateau itself. Shafts just full of sand, shafts that are gated, doors that go into cliff sides that are gated. And that was my point. People don't realize how many entrances there are right on the plateau. And you know, to also tie that back to just with Manu Seifzadeh again, mentioning him and Under the Sphinx, that he was actually, he's brought forward actual hieroglyphic evidence that this repository of knowledge was real. And for example, one that I would cite is called A Hymn to Shu, that he put this in his book too, is a actual Egyptian document from ancient times that literally states there is this archive of knowledge that was written by the hands of Thoth and placed directly under the Sphinx. Basically, it says under Harmachis, which is the Greek equivalent of like Horem Akhet, or what the Sphinx was called on the dream stele of Thutmose, between the paws, Thutmose the Fourth. So he also cites all this other evidence of the existence of the Sphinx before Khafre's time. But it wasn't a Sphinx, it was a lioness, which was named Mehit. And Mehit is the guardian of the sacred archives. That's literally what the name of the statue was beforehand. And then, you know, I think we think probably in Coffer's time it was recarved with the head, even though I don't think that was Coffer's face, because John Anthony West had done some analysis on that with Frank Domingo, New York Police Department forensic analysis expert. So, and they said this is not Coffer's face when they compared it with the statue of him that was found in the Valley Temple. So we believe that the Sphinx did exist for a long time before that, and the work that John Anthony West and Robert Schock had done had also proved that. And this is also where I came from originally. Was I had first met John in 2006, and for years after that, for the following 12 years until he passed, I tried to learn all this stuff about it, and he turned me on to all the other researchers, from Robert to Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall, all the others.
Well, this was like one of the early points of contention, wasn't it? The Sphinx and the dating of the Sphinx and the fact that the water erosion around the enclosure actually indicates a far earlier construction time, potentially going like 10,000 BC plus, right?
Yeah. This is why he brought Robert in early 90s to take a look at it, because it was very clearly precipitation-induced weathering that was implicating a long period of heavy, prolonged rainfall, like a rainforest, basically. So like half the water that landed on the plateau ended up draining straight into the Sphinx enclosure on its southern wall through one particular channel, actually, which got so deeply weathered in that after they brought this forward to the world, the Egyptians went in and filled that whole crack with cement. They covered it up. Because before that, John was standing inside of it, showing how deep it was. And I did get to go to Egypt with Robert in 2019. We spent 2 weeks. I got to see the Sphinx with him. We got to see the Sphinx temple together, which he hadn't been since they recorded the Mystery of the Sphinx in 1993. It was released. And that's a temple not many people get to go in. It's directly in front of the Sphinx, but you need a private entrance permission. So it's another like $2,000 for an hour or something. It only would go to tour groups, would be able to afford it, really. But most of them don't bother because it's just one little temple. So barely anyone ever gets to go into the Sphinx temple, which is directly in front of the Sphinx. And also you might have seen in my films that we know of, there are plug stones in there, that there are tunnels leading out from the Sphinx temple that are very important.
Yeah. How many entrance ways did you say you believe are actually around the Sphinx?
There's six or seven entrances on the body of the Sphinx itself. And then in its immediate vicinity, there's so many more. And then Bill Brown discovered immediately north of the Sphinx and over to the east a little bit, there's this whole cliffside that's got like a dozen gated off or cemented shut entrances. Some of them have huge electronic equipment running, air conditioners and lights. It's like, oh, nothing going on in there, but they're keeping it locked.
No archaeology teams down there. Nothing to worry about.
And we have a map that shows what is actually behind those. They're all little chambers that have square shafts in the floor going down. So right north of the Sphinx, there are probably a dozen shafts going straight down into this network that all connect. I mean, we're talking 100 feet from the Sphinx.
I mean, when was the last time we got like a renegade who was literally just like, I'm going in, and just started like trying to like, you know, dig down? Has there been any stories like
that? Bill Brown. Bill Brown is the guy who's been doing it. I was so surprised when I first met him that I hadn't already met him. Because these GPR scans that we put in my film from 2006, this is from Dr. Ali Abbas with the NRIAG, the National Research Institute of Astronomy and Geophysics. But this was 2006 that Bill commissioned those scans. And we have 9 different GPR scans locations on the plateau itself, all along the Sphinx Causeway, up against the Great Pyramid, all along the Eastern Wall, where we found all these tunnels coming in from the village into the plateau, including the one that we believe connects straight to the Great Pyramid. But he found anomalies basically everywhere he did GPR scans. And even though it was 2006, no one has ever seen these. So when I first realized what Bill was onto, I was like, we need to make a film, Matt. I'm going to meet you in Giza We have to tell the world all of this.
So I don't know much about this character, but by the sounds of it, he's someone that you linked up with in Egypt. And when you met him, you realized that he was extremely dedicated to finding as many of these different anomalies as he could. And he'd been there for a long time. And so you've done work with him for how long?
He had been working with Richard for many years before that.
Yeah.
Richard was involved in a lot of the stories that are in that film as well as the other one. The film that really covers all of Billsburg is Secret Underworld of Giza. That's a three-part. It's about 4 hours total. But Richard was also involved in a lot of those stories.
They're going to be in the description box. Like, listen to us talk, but go back and check out every single thing this guy's done. Because honestly, some of the footage, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen any of this footage before of these different entrances. And like, I saw a video of you, like, you were literally in a cave, was it the Cave of the Snake, just on your own, like hundreds of meters going through in this dark cave. Like, wow, man, this is crazy. And I was watching it like, this dude is on one. He's just down there on his own going through it, trying to find the evidence. That's impressive, man. Like, you know, the hats off to you for actually doing that. You know, all the armchair skeptics sitting there saying this, that, and the other. Here's a guy that's literally getting the sand in his fingernails and going down into the tunnels and finding it. So,
you know. That specifically was, I've been talking to Richard for many years about this. I was talking to Andrew about it years ago, too. I was obsessed with the Cave of the Birds as soon as he had brought that out. I already knew everything about that cave from Richard because he had filmed and photographed every surface. He's found all this evidence of murals that are barely discernible on those walls. And he became completely obsessed with this cave as soon as he first came across it. It's become his lifelong obsession. So I knew the whole structure like the back of my hand based on his maps and descriptions. And I knew what we really needed was proof that the end of it was blocked off. Sahil Wass didn't go in there. They got up to the tube. They had, like, you know, some images into it, but no one had ever absolutely proven that it was a lie. What Zahi's team said on Chasing Mummies, the episode is called Bats. We knew that he sent a guy down into the tube tunnel, and the guy came back out and he said, "Nope, it ends there," which was absolute lie. And we needed to get proof that that was a lie, which is why I crammed myself 20 feet into this hole. I could not possibly have gone further because I needed to get that shot to prove this thing continues. Salt and Caviglia were right in 1817. It does have many chambers past it and labyrinthine passages leading out from all of them that do head straight to the middle pyramid, essentially. And so I think Andrew was right about when he said these, and then we proved all these other things that contextually gave more evidence that it does go right in that direction. So we do have a lot of evidence suggesting that NC2 could connect straight under the pyramid of Khafre, the middle one, which, and at the end of my NC2 thing, I shared this quote actually from Armando May, because I asked him, I was like, look, I'm not going to ask for any sneak peeks of these scans. But if you can tell me anything about the northwest area of the plateau or how NC2 might connect, anything you got, he gave me this perfect little paragraph that was so, I mean, he referred to NC2 as a nerve center connecting to the whole system, but it is not the only one.
Interesting.
He said. And he said the whole city or whatever it is much larger than we thought. It's going to take us a whole year at least to scan the whole plateau, which they are planning on doing. But he absolutely verified that, yes, NC2 is one of the major connections into the whole network. In the other film, when Bill did these scans in 2006, he did one that was along the entire, this is Dr. Ali Abbas. I want to make sure people don't think I'm saying Hawass. It's Abbas, A-B-B-A-S, amazing guy. They censored his report heavily. He tried to tell us even more. But if you look at the films, it describes what happened. Bill gave his own report that hasn't really been known, but told more information about all that. But yeah, literally, like I said, 9 out of 9 places they checked were hits. They found anomalies, these rectangular structures. And the one that was right on the entire eastern base edge of G2, of the Khafre Pyramid, had at least one or two very clear tunnels or chambers or entrances that can be visually seen. So we actually know almost surely the entrance into whatever this structure is under that pyramid from the west and the east, both.
Well, kudos to you, like I said, for actually, you know, going into these places, into the tunnel to actually get the evidence. Yes, it's blocked off. There is more to this. Again, guys, the ancient stories, the relatively contemporary stories from early archaeologists and explorers, like this is something that seems to have been very quickly hushed up in the modern era. But there's like an evidence trail that leads back quite far. The implications are so nuts, man. Like I'm quite an open-ended researcher. I dive into a lot of different topics, but prehistory is something that I'm really interested in, like the implications of a kind of pre-cataclysmic society and, you know, the evidence globally of something that does seem to be connected through the architecture, through the symbolism, through the type of engineering practices. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about Egypt is the difference in architecture between certain sites. Like, you know, you've got like the Assyrian in Abydos, which seems to reflect the same type of cyclopean stone building as Sacsayhuaman in Peru and other areas around the world that have this, you know, kind of fitting together of stones. So there's this weird difference. And what I found, like, you know, you go to, again, like somewhere like the Osirian in Abydos, you've got the Seti the First temple next door to it. Incredible, amazing. Like, you know, what an awe-inspiring and incredible temple, but not as advanced as the ancient, more older structure that's right next to it, which is the Osirian, or at least I would, you know, place a pretty large bet on it being significantly older than the temple that's been built adjacent to it. And this is not to distract from the Giza Plateau, but just to quickly touch on this place. Like, I'm amazed by the fact that it's connected down into the water table, so you literally you can't drain it. It's continuously filling up with water, and there's all these hidden shafts. These all seem to be indicating a deep network of subterranean infrastructure and engineering. Is this the dynastic Egyptians, in your opinion?
That's a great point. That I think you're right. It's not the dynastic. The Osirian is, you know, and it's also like whatever 20 meters lower than Abydos. They didn't even potentially know that it was there, some people think, when they started building that temple. And John West believed it looked exactly like the Sphinx temple and the Valley temple next to it that we know go back to the time of the Sphinx as well. Because stones that were pulled from the quarry as the Sphinx was built were placed into the walls in the Sphinx temple. We can line the layers of rock strata to prove that. And there were other stones also at that time worked into the Sphinx temple from Aswan granite and things like that. Most of the granite there was added later, which is also mysterious because they somehow married it to the front of these heavily weathered stones as if, like, rounded weathered stone, somehow they squished granite up into this complex surface structure as casing stones over these ancient limestone blocks. Nobody can explain. It's as if they had to turn this granite into clay and push it onto there, you know, to get a perfect surface tension with it all. So this does get into, there is something else. There's what I might call the master technology, I've called it, which is, you know, there might have been these things, honestly, like geopolymers and other things like that at certain eras or for certain uses. But there was something else that was a technology that I believe goes all the way back to those earlier times. It is definitely present at the Osirian. And not only that, but at every one of the temples in the south, I think you look under any one of them, you're going to find, you know, the last version of this temple and then the one before that and the one before that. If we have this kind of technology, we might see all that now.
Well, this is the thing. And again, that's actually something that is mirrored around the world with different places where you have, again, an incredible temple, incredible structure. But lo and behold, below the ground is a more ancient, more impressive, more advanced network. I'm forgetting the name of it because it's really hard to remember. Chavín-Dahuanta in Peru. That one's a really impressive example. Okay, that's on my list, my brother. I need to go out there as soon as I can. Peru is calling to me just as much as Egypt, to be honest, just because of these connections that are propping up all over the place. But yeah, the stone work and also the materials being used. And that's another thing that I was mentioning in my video recently on the Giza Plateau, is the fact that you have to take into consideration the actual complementary reverberatory geophysical landscape that you're dealing with, because you're dealing with granite and limestone, acoustic amplification through limestone, piezoelectric activation through granite in the pyramid structures. So the idea of being able to kind of catch resonance and figure out what's underneath subsurface structure vibration is specifically, like, the Giza Plateau is a very unique geophysical environment to do that type of research, right? And it also ties in to just what they were doing with these geoenergetic materials, and, you know, materials that can produce electrical charge under mechanical stress and amplify acoustic, the whole acoustic engineering element of prehistoric temple sites around the world is another thing I'm very interested in, archaeoacoustics or psychoacoustics, and how sound can influence consciousness, which we now know through modern science. This is not, you know, sci-fi. So, you know, the whole choice of specific materials, do you think that this plays a role in whatever it was that they were really trying to do with these structures?
100%. Yeah. The high content of the quartz in that red granite that all comes from Aswan, the quartz is very important in many ways, in energetically, also in there's things we're learning. If you look into Marcel Vogel and his research on the Vogel crystals, the things they can do in terms of what they do to water, structuring water, in terms of potentially actually generating energy when put under pressure, like you're saying. These obelisks, they had many different functions, I think. And I like that you are bringing up also Chavin-de-Hontar is a really important site, which you definitely should get to. But there are similarities between that and also other sites like Mitla in Mexico that I've also seen, right. But they're doing so much.
And Teotihuacan as well, right? The pyramid with the acoustic.
In terms of ones that actually have vast labyrinths of tunnels and snakes underneath them, which Teotihuacan does as well, I think. But Mitla is one of the most interesting ones that
That one's new to me. I'll make a note of that. That one's new to me.
Yeah, my friend Marco Vigata is working on a project there where they're uncovering this whole, it's always been known as this kind of entrance to the underworld, just like Chavin, which is really way out there. It's far from the Sacred Valley. It's up north.
Yeah.
It's the most incredible bus ride. Oh, my God.
I bet.
But you get out there and you the thing is, it's not just it's not just the fact that there are these labyrinths underground, but that they are very clearly all being used for ceremonial initiation rituals of experiencing your own death is what the initiation is.
Yeah. And they produce like standing wave patterns, infrasonic reverberations, and they even found conch shells that had been specifically kind of altered to produce a certain type of harmonic, right? So there's a whole lot of acoustic evidence in those rituals.
Yeah, I mean, almost all of them are utilizing what I would call the sacred science, which you can look into R.A. Schwaller de Lubick's, and he's explaining how these temples are all actually, there is a science to creating a vibrational environment that actually is designed to lift you into higher states of consciousness, to remove you from the everyday mentality. And that's part of what these initiations, it's not just experiencing your own death, which is the metaphor, the story you're using is going into this pitch black underworld, having to navigate a labyrinth, maybe after eating some substances that would be mind altering chemicals even. An experience that absolutely not just is like a representation of death itself, but it teaches you what you are outside your body. It's supposed to give you an understanding of what the soul is. And so it's all, that's the same thing at Giza. It's the duat, the underworld of where you go after death. It's all overlaid on the actual physical structures that are under Giza as well.
Well, this is why you do need, when you're looking into these types of subjects, like a multidisciplinary mind to look at different disciplines, different fields, because, you know, I'm kind of blessed because I do a lot of open research in different areas. So I have guests on, you know, quantum physicists and scientists, people who have different opinions on different models. And I recently interviewed a guy called Dr. Stuart Hameroff. I don't know if you're aware of that guy. No, he's quite well known, but it's not really your field. It's quantum biology. He's a quantum biologist, essentially, and him and a man called Sir Roger Penrose developed this model for consciousness that introduces the quantum mechanics side of it and how is consciousness potentially interacting with quantum fields. And I promise I'm not taking us on too much of a tangent, but it does make sense in relation to the psychoacoustic architecture that we're discovering in these prehistoric sites. Whether or not they had any knowledge of quantum mechanics, I doubt it. It was more likely intuited in a different method, a different way, but the effects can't be argued against. So you've got these, temples and sites that are engineered acoustically. We now know through, modern day science in like binaural beats and the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences that we can influence consciousness in different ways through sound harmonics, through different oscillations. It changes your brainwave from theta to delta to alpha and all of this, right? Changes your state of consciousness. And these quantum biological models that are now coming out are looking at the what are called microtubules inside the neurons. So each of your neurons, the protein subunits are made out of these little kind of helical twisting Fibonacci sequence following tubes called microtubules. And their research is all about how these microtubules are small enough on a micro scale and sensitive enough to pick up on quantum vibrations in fields. And this could be playing a very significant role in how we experience consciousness. So if you think about, sitting inside a giant megalithic stone instrument, an amplification resonance chamber, essentially, and this reverberation is going through you, infrasound is literally rattling your bones because that's how it works. You can't perceive infrasound through the human ear. You perceive it through that bass. So if anyone's ever been to a rave or, you feel that bass going through your diaphragm, that's infrasonic reverberation. And all of this plays a role on a cellular level, on a consciousness level with your body. So what we're looking at, like you said, in my opinion, I think you'll agree with this, we're looking at a lost avenue of science that explored acoustics and vibration and sound and consciousness. And this was a very expansive, very enlightening form of scientific exploration that was more like alchemy and shamanism with mathematics and engineering smashed together. And if you're a fan of Terence McKenna, I'm not sure if you are, but he would call this the archaic revival, bringing back these old methods of plugging into that unified reality, plugging into that, deep state of consciousness, but we're now looking at it through scientific methods. And so, a lot of these ancient practices done in Egypt and around the world, I think, are going to be slowly evidenced just through the way that science is progressing in these fields.
Absolutely. There's so much. I mean, I know of there are vibrational, frequency-based hospitals, essentially, in Egypt. There are resonance chambers. This technology it's not the same as the kind of technology we've developed today, but it is heavily based on the crystalline energies and vibrations, harmonies, and realizing how those things can affect the human body. I think when the Great Pyramid was originally all together and working, it's like you could literally lay down in the king's chamber in that box and be healed of practically anything instantly. There's so many things that the pyramid can do, I believe. That is an entire field of science that is separate from the foundation of our whole field of science. And it really does have a lot to do with these crystals, like you say. And like you said, also a standing wave. A standing wave is a way that I would explain some of these things that people call curses. Because under Giza, it's real. There are these energy fields where if you enter into them, it's going to make you sick. It's going to give you a nasty headache. I felt it in some places before when things were just opened and stuff. There are these pockets it's like radiation almost. You walk into and you get sick. You want to vomit. People get random nosebleeds or hallucinate. They see things that aren't there. There are energy fields that are actually standing wave that's placed in a single spot. And I think the crystal in the bedrock ends up helping to hold those energies in place. So there is actually a science to this idea that there are things that could make, like, Howard Carter's team when he found Tutankhamun get all sick and things like that that aren't woo-woo. It's not magic. There's science to that, and there are protections that are invisible on the Giza underworld and other places. Anywhere I've gone underground in Egypt and other countries where these structures are, there is always a high crystalline content of that bedrock.
In fact, like I recently got back from Malta, where there is a extremely dense concentration. In fact, it's one of the largest, if not the largest concentration of megalithic sites in the world, because it's only a small kind of archipelago of islands just off the coast of Italy. And there's so many sites there. I'm putting out a documentary, meticulously trying to edit it whilst doing all of this madness is just kind of blagging my head. I swear I'm like half asleep all the time at this moment, because I'm just trying to get everything done. But literally, I went to the islands of Malta because of a place called the Hypogeum. Are you familiar with the Hypogeum? And that's another area where you've got
specific resonant
frequency. Yeah, oh, for sure, brother. Have you been inside it?
I've never been to Malta. I know about the Hypogeum, though.
It's a subterranean, multi-level subterranean complex. And when I was down there, you can even see the glistening of the quartz in the stone. Like, the whole place is just completely glistening with all of these quartz fragments inside of the stone. So again, it's an energetic place. It's like 5,000 plus years old, and that's the conventional dating of it. So again, yeah, it just speaks to what you were saying about a definite focus on subterranean resonance complexes. This seems to be a marker of whatever this civilization or kind of global culture was.
Yeah, so much of it is underground, and I keep telling everyone, like, 90-95% of Egypt is underneath still. We're seeing such a small fraction of what it really is. The much older stuff, which is what I'm most interested, the pre-dynastic stuff, it's all underneath. I actually just released another film yesterday that's it's called Egypt's Underground Cities and Long Range Tunnel System, I think, which is an interview I did with my friend Aminya last year. And he describes very in detail, as someone who is an archaeologist. He trained at Minya University for ancient history and stuff. He's telling me in this interview, there is this underground city under Karnak at Luxor. There is two of them, at least, in the Minya district, which is Tel El Marna, Akhenaten's area. There's two there, Tuna Gebel on one side and Beni Hassan on the other side. And these two underground cities there are connected underneath the Nile to each other. And I have another interview about this with another friend who's a very, very respected archaeologist and guide, Egyptologist, who also confirms to me that these underground cities from Luxor to Minya to Giza are all interconnected with this long-range system that spans the entire length of the Nile, probably right on into Sudan, very likely. And these tunnels are discovered in very rural areas, far from any of the temples. Hakim Awiyan, he used to describe playing in the tunnels as a child. He tells one story about one of his friends when they were kids. He went down the tunnels under Giza, and he got lost, and he didn't come up until he was at Saqqara, which is 50 miles away or so. But my friend Cariolis, I just released this video of yesterday. He tells about these tunnels he has been in, where they're telling him he's crazy for saying that Tuna Gebel is actually the city, because you don't see half of it. We're talking about 1,100 tunnels. He calls them streets because you can drive a truck through these ones. And I went deep into this city. I saw the public.
Have you got video footage of that? Because I'll make sure I put it on screen.
I put a little bit of it in a NC2 film, but I have like an hour of footage from what's called the City of the Dead underground at Tuna Gebel. It's an animal cemetery, much like NC2. The North Cliff 2 is the other name for the Tomb of the Birds and the Cave of the Snake. So I have footage of myself going through. I mean, I was alone. I had my flashlight. We asked, you know, got the permission and got out of the main public area, and he let me go. He said, if you want, we might be able to let you into this one that's called the Scary Tunnel. And I'm like, yes, please. But it was unbelievable. Yeah, no, it was we had to push for it a little, but these tunnels it was unbelievable. They were full. I mean, they're 10, 12 feet wide and tall, square.
What kind of stonemasonry are we talking? Is it like the really weird, like, kind of pre-dynastic style, or
square tunnels? Some of them were more rounded, but all of them very heavily like finished. And yeah, these ones, the one that I went deep down into was it was full practically to the ceiling. of these giant potteries that had basically three mummies in each, bird mummies. There was just mummies of falcons and ibis wrapped so beautifully. I put a little clip of it in the end of the NC2 film.
Just sitting there like no one had taken them? And
not sitting there, but piled almost to the ceiling.
What?
I had to,
oh my god,
walk over them to get deeper and deeper in, and I started just feeling really weird about it. I'm like,
yeah,
break something. I was able to take depths that weren't going to hurt it, but after a certain point it was like, I'm not going to get to the end of this either, and they're going to close the site for the day soon. I could keep going.
Yeah, like, do you feel like camping inside this tunnel tonight? Like, not really.
But there's over 1,000 tunnels there. Over 1,000. Over 50 acres. Over 50 acres. And that's just what they were able to explore and map out back then when the French were excavating it. And, like I say, it connects under the Nile to the other ones. And
I mean, yeah, so I mean, it's really sounding like the entirety of Egypt. If you could just get an x-ray scan, you'd just see this highway of, you know, engineered structures. And it just, again, I mean, for me, thinking about the fact that when I was in the Great Pyramid, the implication of now thinking about all of this substructural engineering below my feet, it just kind of gives me like secondhand chills. Like, I had goosebumps just thinking like, oh my god, like, what is actually going on with this? Because there's just no historical record evidence and proof for any of this to exist. It shouldn't exist. And even the pyramid itself shouldn't exist, the Great Pyramid of Giza and, well, all three of them, but the Great Pyramid of Giza with its, you know, the alignments, like, none of it should exist at face value based on what the mainstream wants to say anyway, and yet there it is. You know, regardless of substructural components, regardless of all of that, there is so much about the mathematical engineering and the precision and the, you know, the acoustics, everything. So what do you think in terms of an actual culture? Like, do you sit there and think about the Atlantean stories? Like, are you pretty firmly on the idea that this is pre-cataclysmic and we were once an extremely advanced culture on this planet?
I think there's evidence. I'm really glad you bring this up, because a lot of the context, the real proof to me, it's the context I see that the Hall of Records is not underground. There are written records and technology potentially, I believe, underground, but a lot of it is hidden in plain sight. I've already seen the records because I've seen them in the Great Pyramid, in the dimensions of it. It does encode all that. It's got pi, phi, easy, Pythagorean theory.
Exactly, easy. Exactly.
All of it's definitely in there. Look at Schwaller de Lubeck's, look at Peter Tompkins' book about the Great Pyramid. All of that math, and that's the kindergarten stuff of it. People know that the latitude of the Great Pyramid is, if you turn it into a decimal point, it comes out to basically exactly the speed of light. If you take the speed of light and convert it to a latitude, basically, you're going to land a foot or two away, a couple feet from the actual apex, which my friend Gary Osborne has proven could have been actually exactly the apex at a certain time, given the continental drift of Africa. But then you also have, it is the center of, it's basically the exact center of all land masses on Earth that are above sea level. It's basically the exact geographic center of gravity of all land masses. It is exactly being like 30 degrees on that parallel. It makes it equidistant to the planet core and to the North Pole. So it makes an equilateral triangle with the North Pole and the platter, and the planet core. And so you have all this stuff, and you have this geometry worked out between how far it is, 72 degrees over to Angkor Wat and then to the other sites. It's all laid out on this icosadodecahedron grid of ley lines. But then, you know, people are skeptical of the whole light speed thing. So I just want to say this. I actually determined, I found myself three or four different instances, not just that one, of the speed of light encoded into the Great Pyramid. For example, there's one other. If you take the perimeter of the Great Pyramid base and you circumscribe it with a circle around it that touches all four corners, and then another circle inside it that touches each middle point on the square, and then in meters, you subtract that inner circle from the outer circle, you also get the speed of light, like exactly. But that only works in meters. But people think they didn't use meters. But I've also, with Gary Osborne, we've proven they did use meters as well. They used meters and feet, or pyramid inches. They used the sacred cubit as well. And all three of those units have a specific geometric relationship to each other. And so I don't know if I could prove it right here, right now, but we've got so much evidence to show that they did actually know all of those, as well as seconds and minutes and hours, and they divide the day this way, just like the Babylonians and Sumerians.
That's a lot of effort just to throw a dead guy inside it.
Yeah, for instance, the inch, I'll say, if you measure the Great Pyramid perimeter, it comes out to this number that if you just move the decimal point over, you get exactly 365.24, which is the perfect year, the length of the year. And then in, for instance, Chichen Itza in Mexico, you have 91 steps coming up each side of that pyramid. You add those all up, they're each one season. And with the platform on top, it's 365 steps. So they're both defining the length of the year on both sides. So I'm just putting some of this stuff out to say, yeah, they had some of the most advanced knowledge we could, so far beyond us. And you get into... one other thing I feel I should really mention is Gary Osborne is a good friend of mine. We've studied so many of these same mysteries, specifically about the geometry and math and advanced knowledge encoded into what is hidden in plain sight at Giza. And so this is a big one. The three satellite pyramids by the Great Pyramid and the three satellite pyramids by Menkaure's Pyramid, everyone calls them the Queen's Pyramids. Here's the thing. They're not Queen's Pyramids. These two sets of three pyramids, one's over here and the other one's 90 degrees separate on the other end. And we know that the three pyramids themselves, the big ones, are at a diagonal between those two. And Robert Bovall's theory about the three pyramids aligning to Orion's belt, people have, you know, had a lot of skepticism about that. But Gary Osborne and Scott Creighton wrote a book called The Giza Prophecy. This is amazing stuff they found. They found that the Great Pyramid also references the 23.45 degree angle of the Earth's axis, which also proves they knew the shape and size of the Earth and the tropics and the axial tilt, and also references its own position on the Earth. This is stuff that's in that book. He proves that there's no way. I mean, the codes they used to put this in are so, it takes a mind like Gary's. He's brilliant. But these three satellite pyramids, basically, it is a processional calendar. And I don't know if I can go totally into what, but precession is a 25,920-year cycle. And this is what we believe is from golden ages to dark ages and back.
Yeah, the whole kind of like the great year and the cycles of destruction. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So the Egyptians and all the other cultures on Earth all considered this to be some of the most important knowledge on Earth, is knowledge of this cycle of about 26,000 years. And if you look at these three satellite pyramids, basically the ones next to the Great Pyramid, they will align to Orion's belt in its orientation at one point in that cycle. The ones at Menkaure's Pyramid will align 13,000 years later. They couldn't have been... So this entire thing, you have a line between those two, is the line of precession between, you know, the ones over there are going to align. Those ones over there aren't going to align for another 13,000 years.
I've spoken about this a couple times and kind of trying to flesh out my thoughts on it. But I truly get the sense, and, you know, people will fight me on this, but I really get the sense that what we're looking at here is a form of type one civilization. And it's not the kind of, and for people that don't know, the whole Kardashev scale, which is the idea of like a type one, a type two, a type three civilization, type one using all of the energy of the planet, type two using all of the energy of the solar system or its neighboring star, and type three, all of the energy of a galaxy, which is kind of incomprehensible, God level type of thing. But a type one civilization, we tend to think of that as something like Star Trek, right? A singularity, an artificial intelligence, kind of where we're going in a way. But you can also look at it as the planet itself is a technology. It's full of geoenergetic materials and mechanical processes and currents and flows and electromagnetic energy. So there is just, and it's basically a big dynamo, like, you know, so there is essentially just all of this technology naturally here present. If you can tap into that, you are tapping into this kind of type one level civilization, but in a very different way, in a very holistic, natural way. And who knows what that can produce in terms of aerospace or abilities to leave the planet, but the actual potential of utilizing the planet in this kind of energy conservation, absorption, and utilization process seems apparent in this architecture, seems obvious in this globally present ancient architecture. It's like, it's not just the fact that it's engineered, like you said, it's the fact that it's celestially aligned, it's the fact that it's geoplanetary aligned, it's the fact that it's connected to the telluric energies and the flows of ley lines. Like, there are so many data points that suggest that they were literally harnessing all of these natural flows and mediums and currents of energy. What that does and what they were doing, I don't know. But I think, like you said, it's actually more advanced than us. And when you look at the fact that the pyramid has encoded into it so many different elements of mathematics and physics and orientation to the stars and the planets and then light speed implications and the Fibonacci sequence and pi, like, it feels like a literal information time capsule. Like, hey, like you said, that is the Hall of Records. When we figure out what these things really are, that's the Hall of Records, regardless of what's under the ground.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying is, if you know how to read these codes, you understand the Hall of Records is staring everyone in the face, and it has been for thousands of years. And a couple things just on what you just said is, for one thing, wrapping that also, if you don't believe me about the pyramids lining up to Orion's Belt 13 years apart, there's also a book by Thomas Brophy. Dr. Thomas Brophy is an astrophysicist, and he decrypted the entire megalithic site of Nabta Playa down in the south of Egypt, which was at one point in time probably located exactly on the tropic. I forget what time it was, but it's pinpointing the tropic for one thing, and it's also using Orion's Belt as a indicator of these different ages of basically it's showing the two extreme tilts of the precessional cycle. So it's showing that if they place these stones when they align to those stars, they placed them 13,000 years apart. It must have taken 13,000 years minimum to make that. But it would take actually multiple cycles of 26,000 years to get it perfect. And even with some of these megaliths, they pinpointed these six stars of Orion's Belt and his Head and Shoulders stars. And there's another part in here where they're showing there's a viewing stone where you're looking out to these six stones that also represent those six stars. And they actually pinpoint within the precessional cycle, the heliacal rising of the specific stars for each one, which means in the precessional cycle, there's only one moment. So they would have had to place each one of these six stones thousands of years apart to align it to the birth of that star within the cycle, which only comes once in a cycle. And not only that, but this is all in Dr. Thomas Brophy's book, The Origin Map. Beyond that, these stones are set away from the viewing stone at different random distances, and they're marking different sight lines. The sight lines to the horizon are marking the heliacal rising point of that specific star, but the distance to these, the stones marking them, is also different for each one. And so this started to confuse him, and he started thinking about it. Finally, he just looked it up. Turns out each one of these stones are relatively distanced from the viewing stone to the distance of that star from Earth. And there's more information than that. That book will blow your mind. They've got the fine structure constant of the universe encoded there. They have a model of the universe at Nabta Playa, basically. This is one of the most incredible books in the world, but it's also the same exact thing, proving that not only they specifically used Orion to express that they had a complete perfect knowledge of that entire cycle, but it's using Orion, it's the exact same thing as Giza. So they're locking it in. There's no way you can mistake this as an accident. What Brophy found there, the origin map, that is so mind-blowing. There's no way you can say civilization began 5,000-6,000 years ago. That is done. You can't think that way. All of this stuff does go so much further back.
This is something I think about, and I've got my own thoughts on this. We have gone on such a radically different avenue in our time, in our 4,000, 5,000 history. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's just kind of the random shake of the dice per cataclysm? You're going to come out and emerge and you're just going to take a novel route? Or do you think that this was potentially such a profound time, not just maybe in human history, but in planetary history with what was going on with this advanced civilization, that someone, something wanted to try and prevent that, and there was an attempt to try and pacify that knowledge? Because you got to take into account the rise of kind of monotheistic religions in our history, and the purposeful suppression of knowledge, especially from Egypt, especially this kind of ancient wisdom teachings from Egypt. This was considered very heretical. People were burnt en masse by the Holy See and the Vatican Church for this type of stuff, the Roman Catholics, Christianity, and all of this type of stuff has happened in our period of history to suppress very ancient Hermetic knowledge and wisdom teachings. So, do you think that it's kind of natural roll of the dice? You get hit by a cataclysm, you're going to emerge, and maybe you'll go the same way, maybe you won't. Or do you feel like maybe there's been influence to prevent us from getting to that point again? What do you think?
I think in terms of what the ancients told us, it wasn't random. It is basically understood, especially if you look at the Yuga cycle. It's another version of an expression of the precessional cycle, just like the Mayan long count calendar, or older than Mayan, probably going to Olmec times. There are representations of the precessional cycle all over. Plato called it the great leap year, like you said.
Right. What I mean, though, I don't mean like in terms of the cataclysm being random. Like that's predictable. That's happening each, X amount of years. What I mean is, after the cataclysm, is it just kind of like random? You're going to come out and do a different thing, or is someone messing around with our process?
What I would say is that the way they describe it in the Yuga cycle is they say it has something to do with us orbiting this other black star, invisible star, or body of
Right.
gravity, but essentially saying that there's an effect that affects all of human consciousness, where when we're closer to that other point of gravity, humanity has this spiritual intuition, intellectual, spiritual, if you want to call it that, capabilities, higher consciousness, higher faculties are opened up.
The New Age might call it ascending to fifth dimensional states of reality. And when we're closer to that, we're closer to these higher dimensional states and information.
Yeah, like a golden age essentially is what we would call it, is what Plato basically it's going to oscillate between these golden ages and dark ages every precessional cycle. So you're going to have Kali Yuga, and everything happening now is pretty typical of what happens at the end of these dark ages, when you're the Dvapara Yuga coming back to the golden age. So I believe that the people who put these time capsules under Giza, this was kind of regular practice. It's like, all right, age of the dawn of Leo, time to bury the time capsule. And this is regular within the cycle. And that is, it's a matter of process that right now in the age of Aquarius, which is exactly opposite in the cycle of the dawn of the age of Leo, which is marked by the Sphinx being a lion, by the way, as John brought forward, it is an astrological note to say that. And if anybody wants to actually say that the Egyptians would have built a giant lion statue in any age other than the age of Leo, they don't understand how important the astrology was to this. All the statuary. You have statues that represent the bull in the age of Taurus, the ram in the age of Aries. It all follows this pattern, and those same symbols were used. The zodiac we have today is older than any written language we have today. Those symbols go all the way back. It's always been used. So John brought a lot of edge to that, especially in his earlier book, The Case for Astrology. And so it's a matter of process that when the Age of Aquarius comes around, that's when you open up the record halls from the last age of Leo that were buried last time. This is when we're coming back into enough knowledge to be able to interpret these clues, to be able to read all this math and geometry from the pyramid. And once we start figuring that stuff out, that means it's time some of us, at least within humanity, have gained enough consciousness to recognize that this is this whole other level of science here. Then it starts to be decrypted, and then we find these codes that allow us to get down. And when we reach this certain level of conscious development on a collective level, then we're allowed to get the halls of records, because this technology, it could be a nuclear bomb or it could be a nuclear power plant. It could be used for good or bad. It could be extremely dangerous, in the wrong hands. And so you have to protect whatever this time capsule is very carefully so that, but you know, these golden age minds, and think of like, if the whole world was full of Leonardo da Vinci's and Nikola Tesla's, like if everyone was functioning on a genius level, essentially, and reaching their entire full potential, this was more the focus of society when it was a golden age civilization. So if you have a whole civilization of Nikola Teslas, they're not going to be fooled. They're not going to be able to, they're not going to put protections in place that could be broken through by the Kali Yuga minds that are trying to get the people that are trying to get down into Giza just to steal all this stuff and sell on the black market. Our enemies, the people we're trying to stop right now to beat. So, These record halls are not going to be opened by someone of that low level consciousness, wrong mentality, the wrong intentions, basically.
It's a bit like the mystery schools themselves. Like the mystery schools themselves are available to essentially anyone and everyone who wants to, you know, dive into these types of ideas. But you'll walk right past that door if you're not looking for it, if you're not seeking it, if you're not actually essentially worthy of the information by interest, by validation of your interest and your desire to look for it. That's not an elitism statement. Like I said, anyone could look at these things. But it's, you know, not everyone is going to look at these things. A lot of people just go, oh, that's a load of woo-woo nonsense. And they're just not going to pay attention, right? So, you know, fine. But we're entering the time of the woo-woo, guys. Like, we really are, because quantum physics is telling us we're in a simulation. AI's approaching some threshold of consciousness. You know, we've got virtual reality simulations that are predicting the future. Like, we're in a very strange time period. And I do think, like Terence McKenna said, you know, this is what it's like when a species goes to venture off into the stars. It's a fire in a madhouse. It's absolute turbulence. It's chaos. And, you know, I've said this so many times to my own viewers when I'm just, like, reflecting, but if I think of humanity collectively as an individual, it's very much like a dark night of the soul. Like, you have to go through in your own individual life trouble and strife and stress and pressure. This is what builds you. It's what forms you. It's what grows you. It sucks, but it's true. Like, life is just one of those things where you have to navigate through turbulence. And if I look back on, you know, the most turbulent times of my life, the darkest moments of my life, like, yeah, sure, I wish I'm glad I'm not there. I'm glad I'm not that person. But I recognize that it actually led to growth. It led to strength. And I think about the world right now, man, and how crazy it is and how chaotic it is in basically every sector, from economics to social policy to foreign policy to history to science. You know, everything's being disrupted and kicked around, and the status quo is being broken up. And yeah, I think that that is very good evidence that we're on this kind of teetering edge before a very revelatory series of breakthroughs. Better get yourself ready. Like, start listening, start learning, start getting prepared, because things are going to rush and get faster and faster, right?
Like I say, I think it's typical of this point in the cycle. This happens every Age of Aquarius. 26,000 years ago, we were doing the same thing.
I just love how they were so prepared for it back then. Like, right, get the time capsule ready. Like, we've got this, guys. Humanity has really got this locked in now. Like, we do the time capsule, and now we're just here, like, watching Kardashians and going, this doesn't make any sense. Like, it's all a bunch of stupid shit. It's like we have gone spiraling down some weird little pathway. We need to come back up to this better place of consciousness and you know, try and recover some of this ancient knowledge.
Yeah, definitely. Because it is absolutely, in my opinion, this knowledge and this technology does exist under there, which can overnight transform our planet into a peaceful world, peace paradise. Like, I mean, it can fix everything.
Do you not think they've already been down there? Do you not think some teams, some clandestine, highly funded government op teams might have already been
into a lot of places?
I'm just worried there's nothing left. I'm worried it's an empty chambers, and they've taken all of that, and it's a, you know, like Papoose Lake.
They've taken so much, especially in recent years. I mean, this is what Bill and I were, people we know are like trying to sell us artifacts. I'm like, God, this sucks. I mean, but the most important stuff is protected. It's still there. It's there for when we need it. And yeah, like Bill's one of the stories of one of the many projects he did in the films was he ended up buying a horse stable that's in the village in Nazlat al-Saman. It's like just over 100 meters from the Sphinx, the closest piece of private property to the Sphinx itself. And it was a horse stable. Nobody cared about it, but he and his wife, they detected these energy signatures coming from underground. They knew that it was an extremely important site. It might be the Hall of Records. It might be the Pyramid of Records that Edgar Cayce spoke about, or it's right next to it. But he did determine that there was two tombs directly under it with three tunnels leading out from it, two of which are going basically straight over the Sphinx. So these are almost surely, and then right next to it, he did a project in 2011. He got the Egyptians to clear this whole area we called the cave cleanup area. He removed all this rubble and garbage and just trash. He paid for this heavy equipment to come in, and he uncovered like another dozen doors. These are like right next to the other doors I was talking about that have gates on them. He found like 10 more. At every single one of them, they came in and they filled it. They either covered it with masonry and buried it in, one of them twice, or put a metal gate on it. And nobody even knows Bill discovered all these cave entrances 100 meters from the Sphinx. The tunnels that lead out from underneath his stable property that we already know exist there. One of them goes east, but two of them go west towards the Sphinx. And one of them is locked with a door. No one could get in. But he ended up finding out that this horse stable, which the walls of this structure were like a meter thick, which was like, why? It was like a bunker. He realized it was actually like a German bunker back in the day. He calls it Hitler's bunker. Like the Nazis were trying to get. Of course they were. You know they were.
Oh yeah. Well, this is something that people don't realize is like the whole kind of like Indiana Jones films of the OSS agent going around the world. Like people, the OSS was very real. The OSS was the precursor to the CIA. And they really did have operatives going around the world looking at these German groups like Anna Nerber and the Vril Society and the Thule Society. They were out there trying to go to like, you know, Nepal and Peru and Egypt and trying to find esoteric artifacts that they felt would help the war effort, that would embolden Germany. They were obsessed with the esoteric. And it's funny how these things are fed into society. I have no doubt whatsoever in my mind that Steven Spielberg has been selected as someone to be an orator of certain truths through fiction, and they're presented to us in this way. And I do think that that is a way of culturally bringing us to a place where we won't be too shocked by these realizations that we're talking about right now, right? Because people go, oh my god, so it's basically like that Indiana Jones film was saying. It's like, yeah, it's basically like that, because that's what it is, and they were just telling you that through fiction so that you didn't blow your mind out when they reveal it in real life. But you know, this is something I was, you know, curious to get your opinion on, just in terms of like the contemporary Egyptian government and any knowledge that they have. So they're locking off these places, you know, they're closing down the gates into the Giza Plateau. They're objectively showing that they don't want people to explore any underground subterranean centers. Why? What do you like? How far up the why pyramid do we have to go before we get to a point of like, you know, like Freemason Illuminati control? Like, where do you go with the why of the restrictions?
That's basically what a lot of my films get into, is not only getting actual footage and absolute evidence of a lot of these structures and tunnels, but showing how much censorship, not censorship, attacks. I mean, Bill has got death threats. Richard was almost killed twice to get this information about NC2. That's in the films. We document at least six men who were murdered in the village in Nazlat al-Saman, right next to Bill's stable property at another house right there. Six men were buried alive in a shaft because they found something they shouldn't have. And people need to realize this whole thing, it's not just Zahi Hawass, by the way. He's a gatekeeper, but this thing is, the enemy is above and beyond him. It's something much bigger. There are old families, there are secret societies, there are all kinds of Freemasonic groups, different lodges fighting over these different territories. All these people want to own the idea of the Great Pyramid, the idea they want to own Karnak, all these different temples. They want to possess this occult power. They believe it's which is real, but you know, they want to use it in a very dark way. They want to own it in order to own the consciousness of the planet, to psychologically manipulate. And I mean, some of it is just like, for instance, the entrance in the Tale of the Sphinx. They keep that locked, but I could get you in there if you want. If you got $10,000, you can go down there. It wouldn't be worth it because I'll tell you right now, you go down to the bottom of it and it's sealed off at the bottom. You can go in for $10,000, I could get you in. But it's not gonna you're not gonna be allowed to film it, and you're gonna have to sign an NDA, so you can't tell anyone.
That totally sucks.
This is part of it, some of the lower level stuff, because they know that tunnel used to go to a long chamber underneath the Sphinx, which has been completely denied. But Zahi actually admitted it at one point, and before 1998, when they, when Zahi was under there with Mark Lehner doing all this work, and there's this famous video of him in the tunnels, being like, "Even Indiana Jones wouldn't go here. We're under the Sphinx. We're about to find something no one's ever seen." And then it was in later 1998 when he suddenly came out and said, "Whoops, nope, nothing down there." And I know that entrance, he was told to shut up about it. There are some things I believe Zahi wants to tell that he can't. And so it's hard to say. I mean, a lot of it is his fault. He's been on the wrong side of a lot of this stuff. He's taken a lot of credit from my friends who discovered amazing things like the Osiris Shaft, JJ Hertek and Boris Said, and my friend Ray Grassi. They were all part of, they found the original sarcophagus at the bottom of the Osiris Shaft. They never got credit for it. As soon as they realized that they had found that, the project got taken. When Shock and Robert found the chamber under the Sphinx's left paw, which is obviously the chamber Casey was referring to, that is the entrance way towards wherever the records are. This hole in the tail where they just blocked it off and you can't get into the chamber under there anymore, that way at least. But you probably can from Bill's stable. That's what we're trying to do.
It's just upsetting that people put so much faith in kind of like the mainstream. And I don't want to like completely disparage everyone in mainstream archaeology, because there's some fantastic people who are interested in these things that operate in the mainstream. So it's not a generalized attack, but there is a generalized stigma that I find so frustrating and so unscientific and so uncurious and so unenlightening and bland. And it's like, what's wrong with you guys? Where's your scientific flair? Where's your explorative flair? Why are you not going on the edge of ideas and being those people? Because at the end of the day, it's not, and I said this in my last video, it's not the academic masses that do impressive work most of the time. It's the outliers, it's the edge runners, it's the people who are fringe and have strange ideas who end up many years later being, lauded as the most amazing examples of scientific minds ever to grace our planet. So, people in the mainstream, I do find it very frustrating that everyone's just following such a rigid model. It happens in a lot of fields. I'm very plugged into like the consciousness field. It happens in that field. And again, I just feel like we're really due a major disruption in a lot of sectors.
Well, you did get into it, speaking of, what is really covering these things up. Like I said, there are
Yeah.
many of these gates that it's like, if you're a VIP, I could get you in there for 10,000,
Right.
20,000
Right.
bucks. They can make some money off of that, but that's a separate level
Yeah.
from the stuff that we are really interested in, is the stuff that nobody knows about. And that is,
Yes.
the things we're interested in are the most dangerous, and we are the most targeted. We're the most at risk. Not as much now that suddenly we're getting a lot of eyes on us, but still, we're very targeted for this.
I do think in respect of these types of discoveries, publicity is your greatest ally, and being a known face and a known voice and saying, look, I'm happy in my life. I'm not in any way miserable, and considering any drastic
Yeah,
options. And
I will never ever consider suicide.
these are things that people have to say, because you're not, it's not an over-exaggeration to say that, like you said, that there have been what you might call wet works operations to get rid of people, to remove people that have been problematic and bringing this disruptive information to light. You mentioned, real quick, you mentioned Karnak Temple. Now, I've been to Karnak, and I think it was in Karnak that I had a very strange experience with a statue of Sekhmet, which is quite a famous statue, and I didn't know that at the time. And like I said to you before we got on record, I'm actually usually a bit of an eye roller with people who are like, oh my God, I can feel the energy of this place. Holy shit, there's something going on there. I've been recording everything in Egypt, like every site. I've been trying to get as much video as I could. And I remember when they said that they were going to let us into this area where this statue of Sekhmet is. And my friend was like, this is actually quite a special area. Like a lot of people say that they get a feeling. And I was like, okay, yeah, a lot of people always say they get a feeling. And anyway, so I was going in with my camera and I came around the corner into that very plain. And I love how it's done, because it's such a like a plain square room with sand on the floor and a beam of light coming down like an Indiana Jones film that's illuminating this big statue of Sekhmet. But literally, the moment I came around the corner with my camera and turned it on, turned it onto the statue, my arm just fell down. Like, literally, my arm just fell down, and I just was staring at this statue, and it felt like the statue was locked onto me. I actually did start to get this very strange inertial feeling of almost being pulled towards it, and my like vision kind of narrowed and focused just on the statue. And it was only when my friend was like, "Hey, dude, we're leaving now," and grabbed me by the shoulder, I was like, "Whoa, like, whoa, hang on a second." I was in a trance. And then the people next to me reported the same thing and said, "Did you get a feeling like it was locking onto you?" And I was getting goosebumps from that, because that was the first time in my life that I'd ever truly felt the energy of something like so many people claim. And there's been camera anomalies taking photos of that, and I don't know what it's made out of, but there's something going on with that, right?
That's if you talk to anyone, it's probably more than any other statue in all of Egypt, the one that is most considered most alive. In fact, some locals believe that they lock that shrine room at Karnak because otherwise Sekhmet tears through the village.
Get out.
As in her lioness form. I could list endless stories that one of my friends went in there and didn't quite respect that statue and suddenly got a random nosebleed out of nowhere or very ill. Same like some of the effects of these curses or this.
What do you think's going on there then? What do you think explains that?
The locals believe this is actually the spirit. This is Sekhmet is the she's a force of guardianship for very much like the Sphinx, Mehit, this original lioness that was Mehit, that was called Mehit, was this, the lioness is, that energy is like, what better energy do you want to guard sacred knowledge than a mother lion who will shred to pieces anyone who is threatening her children, but who will guard her children better than anyone. So you need an energy that can differentiate between these. And this is, you know, in the history, that is Sekhmet's role, is as this protector of the sacred knowledge of Egypt. And it's, you can almost see the name Kemet in her name, Sekhmet. That's the name of Egypt. It's, she's the protector of that. And you can also see Mehit in that name too, Sekhmet. And she is also a lioness, just like Mehit, who is this guardian over the library in northern Egypt. So she's the differentiation. You need Sekhmet permission, basically. And never, ever disrespect that statue. Just don't, you know, I'll tell anyone that's listening.
There's so many statues of Sekhmet, though. That's the thing. Why is this statue so resonant and strong with an energy?
That's her official shrine room. That's her official, her sanctuary.
Kind of the OG shrine room for her.
That's her, domain, basically, where she most centered. But you do see Sekhmet or Mut, which is similar. But I've seen like 20 of them. You know, at the Vatican Library, Museum, I mean, where the pine cone is, and there's the big, this is all a metaphor for the pineal gland, and it's inside a white dome, which is, that's like the inside of a skull, the white dome around it, and the lions and the peacocks, this is all part.
They know exactly what's going on, my man. Like, you know, the Vatican has got a lot of this information. I mean, the very fact that they can have something like the secret archives, which I'm not sure if you're aware, but it's like multi-kilometers. It's like 30 kilometers of shelving to store all of the texts and, you know, the different artifacts. It's phenomenal to me that that's even allowed and permissible.
Talk about some of the reasons why some people on Earth don't want this SAR technology coming forward. A lot of people hide a lot of things underground, you know. But what I'm saying here is, like, they have, if you go behind that dome where the pine cone is, it's the Vatican Museum right there. If you walk behind all around it, there are like 15 or so Sekhmet statues there, all taken from Egypt, lining all the way around the back of it in the inside of the building. People don't realize that. And they're all in like a red room, actually, which is like, it looks like you're looking at into a brain, kind of, whereas on the outside, it's white, like you're on the inside of a skull. So, I seeing these Sekhmet statues at the Vatican, I was like, I'm sorry, Sekhmet. I don't know why you're here. I don't know why they stole you here, and why they thought that the guardian whose job it is to protect against those who take this knowledge and don't deserve it, is very, there's levels of irony here and levels of ownership claiming to have some type of power over these statues and like I say, like objects of occult power is how they look at it. These things that have been so venerated and worshipped and honored, the more consciousness and intention that's been paid to a statue, the more power it does have. It has, this is very real. It becomes charged with this. And you can see that. And, you know, for instance, when you look at Kirlian photography, you could look at an object, like an organic object, and you could see its energy field around it. If you look at an object that, nobody's ever thought about or cared about, it's not going to have any field. But if you look at an object, like for instance, a key that takes a lot of thinking and energy to make this object, very delicately, it will have this whole aura field around it. It does have an actual energy that I believe is related to how much intention goes into its creation, which is the same thing for all the temples. If you imagine how much time and care, Angkor Wat, even like these detailed reliefs, the more energy and time and intention is placed into this object, the more of this energy it does have, which has the potential of healing, having positive effects on the consciousness of the observer that comes in, things like that. There is something real to this. So a lot of these more darkly oriented people, occultists and stuff, they want to get that energy and that power for themselves to use for whatever. You know, it's really something that belongs to the whole world. That should be healing temples that everyone can actually use and go utilize these vibrational sciences that can actually heal the body, and not just heal the body, but also activate the subtle body, get the chakras and the third eye open. This was the whole point of Egypt, is to teach you about your own biology and how to open up your third eye, which is, like you said, binaural beats. All of Egypt was about finding this balance or reconciliation between opposing forces, which is the brain hemispheres. And so it's all about teaching you to absolutely balance yourself between the extremes of every opposition. And that's, this whole duality is synthesized into what's called the return to source doctrine, or like law of one, if you want to call it that. The idea that there is a unity, this whole thing that Akhenaten brought and said there is one single, you know, not exactly the same concept, but that there is a creative single source of, you know, the whole universe and all life, the Aten, the energy that comes from the sun. But it's a lot about unifying the two hemispheres of the brain in order to activate that inner knowledge of the thing that is the Nikola Tesla spark, the Leonardo da Vinci, access your full potential. Your inner genius is opened up through that. And so they made a science out of how to actually do that, how to get your chakras activated, open your third eye. And that's the whole point of Egypt. One of the ways that you can actually do that, and we're talking about initiations that can actually remind you who you are as a person, or who you are as a soul, remind you what you are outside your body, what you are after death, what you are in the field of lucid consciousness or in the duat, this world that you are going to face after your death. Is a realm that can be explored in lucid dreaming and such. Egypt is something that can actually teach you about your soul in another way, because if you remember your past lives from thousands of years ago when you're there, and you saw this wall that looked exactly the same, and you see that wall again in this lifetime, that's a trigger. You understand? It's a reference that is immovable in time. It's the exact same as it was then as it is now. And this can trigger people to remember who they were back then. That's why when people go to Egypt, it's like John Anthony West always said, he in every interview, he goes, Egypt is like sex. And now that I have your attention, how is Egypt like sex? And he says, and then he goes, because you can read all about it. You can look at the pictures. You can watch the videos even, but you're never going to have any concept of what it is until you experience it. Because this is the truth. You can't get a sense of the scale. You can't get a sense of the energy that you can't get a sense of what those stones literally do to you, how they affect your consciousness, how they raise you to this higher state of awareness, basically. So that is, like I said, the entire sacred science that R.A. Schwalier de Lubecks brought forward in his great work. He wrote a book called Sacred Science. He wrote a book called The Temple of Man, which describes all this, how at Luxor you see this entire diagrammatic of the human biofield, the entire subtle energy system of the human body, and the perfected man is represented in all the chambers and the layout of Luxor. And so he decrypted all this stuff like a genius. He was a French mathematician, alchemist, astrologer. He was essentially the guy that John Anthony West took off from, picked up on his ideas, reading Temple of Man. And this is what led to John's book, Serpent in the Sky, and all of his work, bringing some of R.A. Schwaller to Lubick's ideas, breaking them down a little bit easier for the public to understand. So, yeah, all those years I was learning from John so much, just like I was always in his library. I was like reading his books and asking him questions. Like I said, since I had first met him in 2006. And, you know, R.A. Schwaller de Lubick is obviously one of the first people he always said to read. And also like G.I. Gurdjieff and some of these other, he didn't recommend too many people, but most of his whole library was like three walls of his house. And two of those walls were basically just books that were from people he knew or people sending them to him, wanting him to write a foreword or notes or all these. And that's what led me to get on this path. So to circumvent all of this different, echo chamber of books that are just saying same thing over and over again, it would have taken me lifetimes to get straight to all of the most important research and theories of all these people.
Well, before we wind down, because we're coming up on the 2 hour mark, there's something else I wanted to bring up with you. Fantastic so far, Trevor Grassi. Guys, make sure you, I know, right? Absolutely flown by. Make sure you subscribe, guys. The link to Trevor Grassi's channel is going to be in the description box below. Definitely check out all of these documentaries he's putting out. Like, you know, the footage is just incredible. One of the other places I want to bring up before we kind of finish off is the Serapeum and Saqqara, because this is another place that I've been to that I find incredible, and it does also tie in my opinion to these acoustic resonance sciences, because the above ground temple site has a lot of indications architecturally towards musical instruments and the use of vibration. And then you've got this subterranean complex with I think what, like 24 of these huge granite blocks, these jet black gigantic sarcophagi that are done with such precision that it's basically on par with current aerospace engineering, with the actual precision of these, the machining precision. So what do you think about the Serapeum? Is this another example of potentially pre-dynastic technology that's just hiding in plain sight? Because the actual mainstream story is that this is for the Apis bull cult, and this is the sacred burial site of Apis bulls, but there were no bulls ever recovered. And these are very small little subterranean tunnels to get these gigantic 70-ton megalithic sarcophagi in. So what's going on in the Serapeum, in your opinion?
Definitely one of the most important sites in the whole of Egypt. Those boxes are evidence of technology that we definitely do not have today. Like I've heard people say, like, if you had like $1 trillion, you might be able to pull enough equipment together to make one, but it's you'd have to develop new tools that it would be basically impossible for us to do anything like that today. And it was clearly done with ease 24 times more than that. You know, that those boxes are everywhere. And what is their actual function? I think there are many. And but I definitely agree that those boxes are probably way pre-dynastic.
Well, they've got these, you get these like scribbly little cartouches on them, and you got this kind of like chicken scratch, and that is certainly done after the fact. That has been done after the fact to probably like try and sell it off to the highest bidder, you know, put a little cartouche on it or whatever, but this is not.
Ramses II tagged his name on everything.
The graffiti artist of their time just slamming tags on everything, right?
And there is also, right next to the Serapeum, you've got at least 4 kilometers of tunnels underneath Djoser's pyramid, all wound up in another one of these labyrinths. And I've gone all through that too, and I've even gone down to some of the lower levels. They're still finding more. They haven't gotten to the end of any of them. That's, and like I say, Saqqara is connected by tunnels all the way back to Giza. That's confirmed. The tunnels go from Giza to Zawiya el Aryan, which is called the Area 51 of Egypt.
That's the one that wasn't originally a military site there, right? This is the one that slopes down, and it's like a kind of a basin that they discovered with limestone blocks, and they even did like a Hollywood film there once, right? Where they had like a scene of them coming down off of the ramp or something, but now they've built a military base around this area.
Yeah, it's a ruined pyramid. The pyramid is gone. All that's left is the underside of it, much like the pyramid at Abu Rawah. But there is something at Zabia El Arian that's there's a major energy anomalies. There's like weird physics doesn't really follow its normal laws there. There's I've heard extraterrestrial objects from off planet there, that there's a big underground complex right under there. There are some things that make it one of the most difficult places in Egypt to get access to. I only know a couple people who have been able to get in there, but there's a very important site connected to it, and there's some kind of like portal energy or some kind of potentially interdimensional thin spot in time space or something like that, some kind of a anomaly, which is why I think they built the military base around it.
Well, there's another thing real quick that one of my friends pointed out to me when we were out in Egypt. There's a lot of these sites, the Serapeum and Karnak and many others, have these very large mud brick fortifications around them that are not actually made of the same building materials as the temples themselves. And I've heard a lot of comments from this, and I love this idea because I think if you are looking at these as some form of energetic temple, some sort of acoustic resonance, or any form of energy, this might be an insulation to keep that energy very much contained within the presence of the temple site. So, would you have any comments on this kind of mud brick insulation hypothesis?
Well, that is actually kind of what my friend Muhammad Ibrahim said. He's one of my first guides.
He's the one I went out to Egypt with, bro.
Who'd you go with?
I was with Mohammed. I was with Timothy Hogan, who's a very dear friend of mine. I was with Johnny Enoch and a couple others, JP Haig. Yeah, a couple others out there, but it was an amazing experience.
I know all of them as well. They've all
Yeah.
helped me in different ways personally, so it's like
Same. I've got nothing but love.
JP Haig, actually, I've been talking with. But Muhammad is a great guide as well, and that's his idea of it. I'll tell you also, Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Schock, and Catherine Ulissi, when I was in Egypt with them, they were on our trip documenting these mud brick structures everywhere, and they were coming up with the hypothesis that actually that was a means of intentionally protecting and preserving these sites. Like the mud brick were structures designed to try and protect the actual older stone monuments from these cataclysmic solar outbursts that would lead to plasma and things that could damage the properties. They're saying potentially like Göbekli Tepe was intentionally buried in Turkey to preserve that site. That m many of the spots in Egypt were intentionally buried to preserve them like that. And that also leads, he has an article about, I think it's called The Intentional Burial of Egypt. So they were developing this idea as I was with them. They were taking all the pictures of the mud brick. And one of the most important ones was at Hawara, because that's a mud brick pyramid, but that's not what Herodotus said. He said this pyramid was inscribed with giant figures all over it. You don't inscribe images into mud brick. There's a stone pyramid under the mud brick at Hawara. Nobody knows that. And the first person to prove it was Bill Brown. So watch my films. You'll see he went there 2007, 2008. The reason they finally kicked him out after 2.5 years, like $500,000 invested in that project, when he was the first person ever to do GPR scans and find the labyrinth. But it was concurrent as well with my other friend Louis de Cordier, I was just talking to this morning, he who brought the Mataha expedition in 2008 to work there, and they also did GPR. But after that whole project, Bill got kicked out. Zahi took the project back from him after he not only designed a system to lower the water at Hawara and drain it so we could get in there, and discovered, you know, where this secret entrance is into the labyrinth. But he also did GPR scans around the pyramid that were actually on the pyramid. He found the original corner of the stone pyramid deep underground, and he was not supposed to know that or tell that. That's when he lost the permit that got kicked out. And Zahi took his report. Zahi offered him a job at that point. He respected the work he did. And he developed this entire plan to actually drain the water and protect the site from the water that's damaging it now from this canal. But Zahi took his report, and they handed the permissions over to a French team, and who didn't use it, who didn't pursue the, you know, the water drainage system thing. And you know, he thanked Bill personally and said, "This was good work. Do you want to come work on my personal team?" And Bill politely refused. He said, no thanks, because I want to be able to say whatever I want to say. If I work for you, I'm not going to censor myself for media control. Yeah, he politely declined, but it showed Zahi respected what he was doing even. But at the same time, kicked him out and wouldn't let him continue.
Join the team or get the fuck out, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. And it was really when he found that the actual corner of the pyramid down there, that was when it was like, all right, you're done, Bill. Yeah. So we are trying to bring it back to Huara too in the future with Louis de Courier and Bill and me and all the others who have been working on it.
We could go for hours on end. I swear to God, like, this is just one of the most fascinating subjects that I get into anyway. I'm very focused on the implications of ancient history, prehistory right now. And Egypt is just, it's always been an obsession of mine, like, ever since I was a little child. If I even put a message out on X recently, and I got thousands of responses back from people saying, yep, same here, same here. And I said, did anyone else between the ages of about 6 and 10 become obsessed with Egypt out of nowhere, inexplicably? So many people do. And I think there's something to that. There's something that calls people to Egypt, because there's just so much there that is a reflection of what we once were and what we might become again. You know, so it's a fascinating thing. But again, I would encourage people, please, Trevor Grassi, check out the YouTube channel, check out his documentaries. We're going to definitely have another talk at some point. Maybe we might even link up in Egypt in the future and do some projects together and filming, who knows. But it's a fascinating thing. I think that you guys are doing incredible work. You're doing the boots on the ground stuff that a lot of these armchair skeptics wouldn't even bother to think about doing. So hats off to you, man, and best of luck with everything. And let's hope as well that they can find a way to push this Khafre project into the mainstream in a way that isn't just dismissed, because if it's really what they think it is, the implications are beyond amazing.